tonight on Arena. Baltimore, Robot Dreams, the Persian version, and Immaculate are the movies up for review. And French-Irish musician Fiona Monbet talks to us about her eclectic musical life. Five 1551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us live if you are so inclined. RTE.ie/arena is where you will find the live stream. Movie reviews to start this evening. Baltimore is a film based on the true story of English socialite Rose Dugdale, who joined the IRA in the 1970s. Dugdale, who died just last week at the age of 83, is played by Imogen Poots. The film tells the story of the infamous Rusborough House robbery in 1974, in which Dugdale held up Sir Alfred and Lady Bight before escaping with 19 paintings, including a Rubens and a Vermeer. Robot Dreams is the latest animation from Pablo Berger. It's the story of a lonely dog who orders a robot online to befriend it. Then he loses it on a beach and trouble ensues. It's an unusual film for sure, as you can get from the plot outline. The characters have no names and there's no dialogue at all. The Persian version is a comedy drama directed and written by Mariam Keshavarz. It follows the struggles of a young Iranian-American woman who's often at odds with her family, particularly with her mother. The film had its world premiere at the Sundance Film Festival last year, where it won two awards, including the Audience Award and for the US Dramatic Competition. And finally, Immaculate stars Sydney Sweeney as a devout nun, Cecilia, or Cecilia, trapped in an ancient Italian convent that conceals twisted secrets and unspeakable horrors. Ruth Barton and Justin McGregor have been to the movies for us. They're both with me in studio this evening. Baltimore is where we will start. This is the story of a young Rose Dugdale, the heiress and IRA member, who of course died earlier in the week. She has a life that I think it's fair to say, Ruth, would be makes interesting movie material.
Oh, she does. And I mean, she's not unknown either. We've had a recent biography of her published not long, in fact, before her very recent death. And she's, I mean, I remember growing up, she was a name, one of the names that you grew up with. In fact, similarly, Eddie Gallagher, her partner and father of, they had a child together. These are figures from you know, my youth and from growing up. And then there was, you know, remember there was the Tieta Herma kidnapping,
which Eddie Gallagher
carried out in order to try to get her released from prison. Because, I mean, no, you know, I don't think there's any surprises that we can reveal here, because we know
her life is well known.
It's well known. She
and had the Rusborough House, the Rusborough House robbery, was she was using that as a kind of she was looking for some leverage there as well.
She was looking for leverage there because she wanted to get the Price sisters released from prison in England, where they were following the London bombings that they had carried out. Actually, in a kind of ironic twist, one of the sort of revelations in the film is them letting it be known they didn't want to be released by her activities, and could she please back off?
Yeah.
And I think that's because, you know, what the film is very good at is she has this extraordinary privileged background. She is an English heiress. She's a debutante. Mm. She's been presented at court. She's only presented at court because she trades this off with her parents against a place in Oxford, studying PPE. And this is like politics, whatever it is, and economics. Philosophy, politics, economics, which is the course that all future English cabinet members took. So she's, you know, a member of the aristocracy, and she's a member of the academic elite as well.
And she was a very, and we get a sense of this in the film, the way the film is told, Justin. It's, yes, the focus quite definitely is in and around this Rusborough House event, but we get a sense of who she was as a child and the family dynamic, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, no, it's actually, it's really, really well structured. There aren't really flashbacks. It's more Rose remembering things that happened by events that are kind of are happening around her. And one of those is, you get the feeling she's beginning to say, how did I get here? You know, what's brought me to this point in my life? So not just remembering some of the details of the robbery we don't know yet, but also remembering, yeah, making this deal to go to Buckingham Palace, to go to Oxford, and then making a dressing as a man and going into the Oxford Union when women weren't allowed in.
That's a great scene, actually.
Which is a great scene. No, just to
women
have one
allowed
drink.
In.
And then it all goes quiet. It's just music and they're swearing and throwing glasses. Like, it's just fantastic. Yeah. But you just see the kind of, I guess, baby steps from that to the bomb making and her being kind of trained and showing off her skill at making the bombs.
Let's listen to a clip from which actually deals with part of that early family life. She's in a gallery. Imogen Poots plays the young Rose Dugdale. Carrie Crowley plays the mother here. They're in a gallery looking at a Velázquez painting, The Kitchen Maid, and Rose already has her art critic skills in place.
It's 1957. I'm 16. I'm with my mother at a gallery. We find ourselves in front of a painting.
What do you think about the maid in the painting?
I'm drawn to the jug she's holding.
I like her positioning in the frame. I think that's what makes this painting so... I don't know. Moving.
You find it moving? In what way, my love?
I don't know.
The truth is, I'm not sure exactly. I don't have the words. It's just a feeling I have to do with the young black girl, the maid. There's something about her being the subject of the painting, not Jesus and his disciple, but her. For some reason, I find that moving.
And that's Imogen Poots as Rose Dugdale. And you also heard the voice of Carrie Crowley there as the mother of Rose Dugdale in that scene from the film Baltimore. And I was saying as we were listening to that, Ruth, that she's a very interesting character. And you get a sense there of the social conscience. You mentioned that she studied philosophy, politics and economics. You get a sense of the social conscience that's in there. And it's very much a left-wing outlook, which would not be in tune with her conservative, I'm pretty sure, blue background.
But far from it. In fact, in one of the sequences, she leads a raid on her parents' house to steal the valuables from her parents' home and is caught. And you know, her accomplice, because he's not blue-blooded, gets a jail sentence. But because she's seen to be a sort of flighty heiress, she doesn't. So there's a sort of really nice critique of the system that she comes out of.
And that, Justin touched on it today, the split screen, and they aren't quite flashbacks. The way that is Christine Molloy and Joe Lawler, the way that they tell this story is quite interesting visually.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you've got to remember, you know, AKA the Desperate Optimists, and they do come from a fine art background. Mm. And you know, if you've seen sort of some of their earlier works, they're really more gallery works than they're certainly not coming out of a kind of conventional narrative cinema. And you know, I see this film almost as belonging, you know, if you remember those sort of films that came out on Channel 4 late night, the sort of experimental films that sort of sit somewhere between art film and narrative cinema, and I put their work in that. We talked about Rose Plays Julie on this show a few years ago, and they've moved slightly more in the direction of narrative cinema, but you shouldn't expect conventional storytelling.
It doesn't have the pacing and the plotting that you might expect from a general narrative film, because the hold up or the robbery of Rusborough House. This wasn't a pleasant affair for the two people and the people in the house, Lord and Lady Bight, and the people, the others who were in the house at the time.
No, this could have, you know, in the wrong hands, this would have been an action movie. And it's not the right choice, because I think it's much more interesting that they go into Rose and her background. And part of it is their incompetence. Like, it is a messy robbery. They don't even kind of properly search the house. There's a cook wandering around with a knife. She's pretending to be French to sort of set up a false trail. She forgets to always use her, doesn't always use her French accent. So there's really this sense of they're bungling the burglary. Yeah. But it's done at a really human level, and it's done very much like slow cinema. It just unfolds in this kind of real time, and there are some assaults that are quite disturbing. There's a lot of anger and things going on, but it's done at this really personal level rather than
the two that are involved with her in the robbery are identified here as Martin, played by Lewis Brophy, and Dominic, played by Tom Vaughan Lawler. How do they, what kind of dynamic do they give to the energy that we can hear even in that clip from Imogen Poots? It's quite an internalized type of energy.
Well, certainly Martin, played by Lewis Brophy, has a real temper.
Yeah.
And really, for no reason, snaps at the Lord and Lady, hits them in the head and causes quite a bit of physical damage. And Dominic is trying to be much calmer, and he's really sort of slowly falling in love with Rose as a revolutionary, not as a woman, but as a comrade. And it's sort of really interesting to see him come around to sort of her side and seeing her as this sort of important figure in the Provisional IRA.
And Eddie Gallagher then, played by Jack Mead, who isn't in Rusborough House. He's in Baltimore, which is where the title of the film comes from.
I mean, here's one of the ironies of the film. She actually never gets to Baltimore, even though the film is called Baltimore. He has a very, very minor part in it. And the film isn't interested in him. I think that, you know, of the kind of secondary characters, I think Tom Vaughan Lawler is fantastic. He just brings that kind of gravitas to the role. He's just got something about being just such a good actor. He's thoughtful. And he has a presence there that...
And Dermot Crowley as the neighbour farmer, Donald, that we're terribly unsure what's actually happening, what's real and what's been imagined.
He's losing his sight, and so we're not quite certain if he's seen what he thinks he's seen, which is the accomplices with her in her hideout. And she's not certain if he's seen it. And then he's not quite certain if she's going to actually kill him. And... she's not certain if he's going to tell the police. So there's a lot. It's a really interesting part.
There has been some criticism in and around this, around the portrayal of Rose Dugdale and her actions, and maybe it's what we don't see that is more problematic than what we see. What's the controversy? And is she treated fairly, and are her actions questioned?
This was following the screening at the London Film Festival. Quite predictably, the Mail on Sunday went off at a rant saying this is a film that glorifies terrorists. And of course, with the background of the Gaza crisis going on at the same time, you know, they had extra leverage when they were rushing to the columns. In fairness, we see her assembling bombs and becoming a good bomb maker, but we never see those bombs doing any damage, whereas in fact we know that in real life they did, and she was a very good bomb maker. And so indirectly she did cause damage, destruction and death. The film doesn't go into that. It does stop at the moment of her arrest. So at that point she's had an unsuccessful attempt at a helicopter attack on Strabane, which again, as Justin was saying, because they're so incompetent, the whole thing doesn't.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say actually what was her part in things and was she responsible for the deaths of
people? So that side isn't
that's not what they're interested in. So you could say that's a fault.
And performances, Imogen Poots clearly carries this film for the most part.
She's in a cabin in the woods, you know, just off this farmer's property, and her struggle and her expressions without any dialogue leading into these memories and us really getting a sense of the struggle without a big speech about it being a struggle. We actually see that's what she's going through. And as Ruth says, I mean, it is definitely sympathetic to, I guess, her journey to this point. I think there's just enough room for us to not get fully sucked into that and recognise that this is a really complicated point of view that she's taken on, and it's led to some bad decision-making and terrible outcomes.
Stars?
Imogen Poots is great. I just think for the performances, and I think for avoiding that action film and going into the personal behind this event, I think it's 4 stars.
4 stars. What are you saying, Ruth?
Yeah, I drifted between 3.5 and 4, but I think I'd go 4 on balance.
Four on balance. That's Baltimore, or Rose's War, if you're in the United States, I believe is what it's called over there, which it maybe puts the emphasis more on her, I guess, than the more neutral title of Baltimore does. Let's move on then to Robot Dreams, an animation based on the 2007 graphic novel of the same name. What do robots dream about, or what do we find out about robot dreams in this particular film, Ruth?
I just thought this film was absolutely charming. The reason we encounter the robots' dreams is because Dog, and these are just their names, Dog is this lonely dog in New York City. It's sometime in the 1980s. And so he looks up a catalogue that advertises a robot friend. He buys the robot. He has to assemble it, which is a brilliant sequence because these two incredible animated pigeons watching, peeping in the window. Yeah. It was a row of animated pigeons. And the robot becomes a friend, and they have this sort of tentative friendship builds up into the, you know, just holding hands. But it's not so much a romantic friendship, but they go to the beach. And they go to the beach, and as anybody could have told Dog, robots don't take well to salt water. They come back from the beach, they lay down, robot can't get up again. He's salted up. He's completely rusted up in a second. Dog wants to go and rescue him, but the beach is closing down for winter. He fails in the rescue attempt, so he just puts a note in his diary, rescue robot, 1st of June, when the beach opens again. Robot's left on the beach and starts to have dreams. And the first dream, we don't realise is a dream because we think he's going to be rescued. And then we realise that the rescue is a dream, and actually that's not at all what happens.
Right, okay. I'm already intrigued by the whole thing. So we have robot, we have dog. What other kind of characters have we here, Justin?
We have three nasty bunnies.
Nasty bunnies.
And we have, there's a wonderful, because yes, it's sort of 84, 83 maybe in New York, and there's a Mars Blackmon animal. So Mars, the character from Spike Lee movies, is there anamorphized into an animal sitting on the subway behaving like Mars did in the movie. There's lovely little sort of 80s. So,
are these cutesy animals that are anthropomorphized? Whatever, no, that word with too many syllables that I've just
punk
put into.
There's like a punk gang that lives in the neighborhood that keeps giving the finger to robot and dog as they walk by. So no, it's New York, but it's animals. And so there are punkers and there are, you know, gangs, and there's all this other kind of stuff.
And no dialogue here at all, Pablo Berger, who's the director here, he has a history in this, or in the whole idea of silent movies.
Yeah, no, he loves to work in silent films. He's really into his visual storytelling. I mean, the graphic novel was the same. The graphic novel didn't have any speech bubbles. And it just really makes it makes it work so wonderfully, and it really connects you to his friendship. And when you start to realize what the dreams are, it gives you this wonderful layer of confusion about what's real and what's not. And it's really, as an adult watching, my 5-year-old saw me watching a cartoon, and she was right there. And we watched two different movies. She loved it and was sad at the end. But for me, it was bittersweet. It's about friendships and friendships that end and new friendships that start. And it's really a wonderful kind of film for 7 to 70, as they say, or I guess 5. 7,
okay. And what is the look of the animation here, Ruth?
Quite simple drawing. Quite simple line drawings with just sort of fill-ins. Much of it is black and white. There's a bit of colour, but the animation manages to bring great expressiveness to the characters. There's a particular sequence that I loved: robots lying on the beach, these birds nest on him, but the youngest of the fledglings can't fly, so robot moves his mouth in a line that imitates a bird's wings. The fledgling looks at robot, works out that that's what he should be doing, and manages to fly. And it's the most simple animation. Wow. Anybody could do it. Yeah. But it's pitch perfect.
Yeah, so
while there is no dialogue, there's a use of September by Earth, Wind and Fire.
Yeah, I believe
that is
the
absolutely
soundtrack
fantastic.
Yeah, so that all worked for you. So first of all, Ruth, I don't know, did you go totally alone, or did you have any younger people with you?
No, unfortunately, I'm well past 5-year-olds, so I didn't have any younger people with me. But my inner younger person loved it, and my older adult person was just really moved by that kind of story of friendship. And also, you know, it's weird, but it does bring you back in time. Even they have the Dark Side of the Moon poster above his
and
bed.
And the Twin Towers are
all over New
York.
The Twin Towers are there, and so that's always a really poignant thing.
Gives that, and I suppose the fact that they're there in animation, it's a quite definite choice to have them there.
No, they're there in the background. Yeah. Sometimes they're slightly out of focus, which is kind of heartbreaking, you know, when you know what's coming.
And so, also, I think having AI as not being a threatening force, you can do that much better in the 80s than if you set it now, because a robot now would be a threat.
Yeah.
Whereas in the 80s, there was all that potential for a robot to just be a fantastic companion.
And that it was, we were the manipulators rather than potentially the other way around, which is, of course, the paranoia of today. So both Ruth and her inner child were very happy stars from both of them together.
Both of us liked it very much, gave it a 4, could have gone to a 5. I just thought it was great.
And what about you? You had your actual child.
Yeah, I had my 5-year-old. Now, to be fair, she likes to say 5 now that she's 5. But I said, that's a really good movie. How many stars would you give it out of 5? And she went 5 with full confidence. So 4 from me, 5 from her. It's probably both.
Okay. Robot Dreams by Pablo Berger sounds absolutely, and obviously we have no clips because there is no dialogue. The Persian version. This is a large Iranian-American family gathering. A family secret is uncovered that catapults an estranged mother and daughter into an exploration of the past to discover stuff that, well, in fact, to discover, I suppose, you're more like your mother than you think you are. This is what this particular girlfriend said. It has the smack of autobiography off at this one, Justin, I think.
Yeah, no, very much so. I mean, she dedicates it at the very end.
It's Mariam Keshavarz.
Yeah, Mariam Keshavarz. And she does want to be, the character in the film wants to be the next Martin Scorsese. And obviously, the filmmaker, you know, says on the poster, based on a true story, sort of. And so there is, I mean, it's a little clunky, that device, I think, when it gets away from the fact she wants to be a filmmaker. But it does become about narrative and who's telling their story, which is really, really interesting, because the daughter's telling the story of her family. And then there's a moment in the film where the mother takes control of the narrative and tells the story that the daughter doesn't know. So you're really kind of, you know, almost like Rashomon, putting the story together yourself. And there's some very harrowing scenes, but it really pays off in their relationship, especially at the very end.
Well, let's listen to a scene. And this is where the daughter is telling the story. And the daughter is...
Layla.
Yes, Layla, played by Layla Mohammed. And here she is explaining how the family came to New York.
The U.S. had a shortage of doctors because of the Vietnam War. So they recruited doctors from Iran to work in America's inner cities. My dad opened his practice in Brooklyn. We were supposed to be here 5 years for my dad to complete his internal medicine specialty. Then 5 years became 15.
Ow! Mom, that really hurt.
Then there was the revolution. And then the war. So we didn't go back.
And that is Layla Mohammed in the character of Layla, who is, I guess, the stand-in for Mariam Keshavarz in this particular film, the Persian version. What Justin said sounds quite interesting to me, Ruth, this idea that we start, because that clip suggests a very traditional narrative, Iranian-American girl, two cultures, fish out of water, etc., etc., etc. But the fact that we then, it shifts focus and we go back to Iran with the family, or certainly in flashback, do we?
Yeah, I mean, she is an unreliable narrator. So in fact, we learn that there's far more to the reasons of why the family, and she, throughout the film, her father is lying in hospital waiting for a transplant. So he's not able to tell his side of the story. So she ends up having to take care of her grandmother. And it's her grandmother who eventually dishes out the family secret. And the family secret brings the story back in flashback then to Iran at the time when her mother, Shireen, who is just played by this fantastic kid actor in the flashback, who was 13, I think, at the time, you know, who 13 or 14.
Yeah, Kamana Shafisayabet is the name.
Yeah, I mean, she's just a stunning young actor.
So she's the mother as a teenager.
She plays the mother as a teenager, and she's married off as a child bride to do the father. So she's 14 when she's married. He's in his early 20s. She's pregnant almost straight away. They're shipped off to this very, very remote part of Iran, and then when she's pregnant, almost immediately with the second child, a crisis happens. I won't go any further into what, you know, because that would give away the surprise.
Too much, yeah.
And then, I mean, I found that part of the film incredibly traumatic, really. And it explains much, much better why they came to America, but also why there are these kind of coolnesses and silences in the family, because there are very big secrets being withheld from the children.
Yeah, and of course that's... And are we in the secrets in a way that Layla, who is our current, who is the daughter in America, are we in things in a way that she isn't, or are we learning as we go along as well?
We're in on things that she doesn't know about, which is what's so fascinating. We get this kind of perspective, and shifts tone. The film shifts tone as well, because Layla's kind of version of the family is, you know, the brothers are a bit silly and goofy, and it's a bit lighter.
She's
at that
eight
stage.
Brothers. Should have said this. Eight brothers, one daughter.
The eight brothers and one daughter, and so we see, you know, we, like you say, we think we're going to see all of this from her perspective, and then inside the grandmother's story, the mother seizes control of the narrative and says, I'm going to control my own narrative. And then we start to learn this other side of the story that is well beyond what Layla's been telling us. And in those moments, as Ruth said, it actually becomes this very intense drama. Yeah. It becomes really heartbreaking. And then it returns to the present of the day of one of the brothers' weddings, and it gets a bit light again. But this, we now know the secret that's going to bring them into their sort of final moment together.
And do I give too much away if we find out about the character of Maximilian Balthazar, my favourite character name in a long time. He, of course, he's an actor, isn't he? Yeah.
Yes, he's playing Hedwig. Hedwig in The Angry Inch.
He's a comedian played by Tom Byrne. Are we giving too much away if we start talking about his relationship?
I don't think so, because it happens very early on.
Yeah.
So Layla is she's had a gay marriage in the past, and this is one of the family traumas, because obviously the quite devout Iranian family is not too pleased to find their daughter marrying another woman. That's over by the beginning of the film. She has a one-night stand with Maximilian, who's in drag the whole way through because of his part, Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And of course, true to the preconditions of it being a melodrama, she falls pregnant after this. And so she's, you know, this gay woman who happens also to be pregnant. And of course, yeah, she's going to, you know, go into labour by the end of the film.
All right. So stars on this one.
Oh, for me, it was easy 4.5, if not more, but 4.5.
Ruth?
Yeah, I was actually, I found that the lurches in tempo and the kind of movement between sort of stand-up comedy and the trauma of the original narrative, I found that a little bit jarring, so it was 3.5.
All right, let's move on to our final film. Sydney Sweeney stars as Cecilia, an American nun of devout faith embarking on a new journey in a remote convent in picturesque Italian countryside. Her warm welcome quickly dissolves into a nightmare as it becomes clear her new home harbours a sinister secret. Let's have a listen to a clip. She's in the confessional box at this point.
I promise to carry myself with grace because I want nothing more than to belong here. I'm afraid I've already messed things up. I'm sorry for these. Yearnings?
She's sorry for these yearnings, and she's even frightened to say that word. I presume, is she speaking to Father Sal Tedeschi in that scene? I'm getting, she's confessing to one of the priests.
She's confessing to one of the priests, or is it the cardinal? No, I think it's the cardinal, I think. Not that, I mean, they're all pretty interchangeable, the characters. So I wouldn't break your heart, you know, if you couldn't remember which one was which.
Yeah.
If you couldn't remember anything of having seen the movie 2 hours later, you'd be a happier person.
I believe it's several types of movie.
Well, it's primarily a really bad horror movie, but it did have this sort of secondary effect. We both went to see it in a crowded cinema. There's a point where a horror movie is so bad that everybody's laughing at it. Everybody was cracking up, because by the end of the film, where she turns into this, she goes from being this sanctimonious nun, novitiate, to being a nun, to being an absolutely kick-ass final girl while giving birth. So she's in the full pangs of labour while burning the house down. By this stage, yeah, the cinema wasn't exactly what the narrative put it that way.
And it sounds to me like real gritty realism here, Justin.
It started well, that's all I'll say. It did start like a horror film, and it did come to this fork in the road where it could have gone Rosemary's Baby, it could have been like Supernatural, or even Psycho, where the natural is even spookier than the supernatural. And instead, it goes to like A View to a Kill, a not very good Bond movie. And it turns out the priest is a Bond villain with this insane plan to bring back Jesus with some blood that he found that's on this nail in their basement. And it's just like, what? Did this just become?
But Sydney Sweeney, does she?
She's really good.
Yeah, she's really good.
Yeah, she's really good. And in fact, she was one of the producers of the film. So you can't even blame the filmmakers, you know, casting poor Sydney Sweeney in it. This was her idea.
Okay, here's a little bit of breaking news that I think I can go to. Can I go to this piece of breaking news? Yes, I can. The Oscar-winning actor led... Oh, the Oscar... let me just make it bigger than it is on the screen in front of me for a second. Yes, little bit of breaking film news. Peaky Blinders creator Stephen Knight has confirmed that Cillian Murphy will reprise his role as gangster Thomas Shelby in the forthcoming spin-off film. The Oscar-winning actor led the popular six-season British crime drama, ran from 2013 to 2022. It was announced in 2021 that instead of wrapping up the series in the seventh season, it would end up in a movie. That's extraordinary. I didn't get your stars on Immaculate before we go.
I'm giving it one star for Sydney Sweeney and one star for the fact that it is quite short. So two.
All right.
Mine's 1.5. You know, I know why she wanted to make it. There are these Gialli films, these Italian horrors, and it would have been great if it had been one of those. And they had great titles like Death Laid an Egg. And
all right.
I think maybe Immaculate Laid an Egg.
Immaculate. Immaculate reviewing from both of you this evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Ruth Barton and Justin McGregor there. Baltimore, Robert Dreams, The Persian Village, Immaculate were the four films that we spoke about. A Fiona Monbay is a French-Irish conductor, violinist and composer. Began her jazz career at a very young age before joining the Conservatoire National Supérieur de Musique in Paris. Later, she went on to devote herself to conducting. Her impressive repertoire ranges in everything from classical to contemporary and jazz and indeed Irish trad. In 2021, she conducted the premiere of the opera Elsewhere by Irish composer Michael Gallen, which was at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin. It's heading out on tour this April with shows in Dublin, Castleblaney, Cork and Galway. Before this, though, Fiona will also be conducting Gallen's latest work, which is called Bod on Altar, A Boat from the Other World, which will make its premiere at the Théâtre National de Bretagne, or the National Theatre of Brittany. And that's tomorrow, on Friday the 22nd of March. And obviously, Fiona is going to be at that, so she's joining me on the phone this evening. Talk to me a little bit about this Bod on Altar. I know that Michael Gallen is very interested, Fiona, in this whole idea of, you know, the other side and these liminal spaces and kind of very thin veils between this world and the other world. Is this what's reflected in this new piece?
Oh, hi, Sean. Thank you for having me. Yes, Michael's music is very, very particular in that way that it's always a sensation of in-between worlds. And this is something that I think grows more and more the more he's writing music. And the piece we're working on and we just did a run through today at the dress rehearsal, it's an amazing piece. And it's about also this finding a sound with this orchestra, a very, very beautiful song with the orchestra, and putting in the soloist Irish traditional music, beautiful musicians. I'm with Donal O'Connor, Moraine Cowliffe and Claire Sands. I actually say hello to you. and it's very rare to have, you know, this two music coming together, but in a very right way. And it's a lot about blurring the boundaries.
These lines, even the boundaries between various types of music. But you have been doing this, as I said in the introduction, Fiona. You began your jazz career at a very young age. This is before you went anywhere near classical music. So bring us back to jazz, where that came from, and then the move to classical.
Oh, I always did both, actually. I was like learning the classical violin in the small conservatories of my town near Paris, where I grew up. And I met a French violinist called Didier Locaud. He was my jazz teacher for the 10 next years. And so I always was doing both music, and they were giving something to the other music, and I just always feel I love different types of music because it gives other perspectives and maybe it's the fact, the double nationality, I don't know.
Yes, because you always... just give us that. What is the connection with Ireland? You're living in France at the moment, are you, or do you live here?
I am. I'm French, and I'm also Irish. My mother is Irish, so you know that makes me a nicer French person. my mother is from Cantitirone, and she came to France, 30
I wonder now, if you were on French radio, if you were on French radio tonight, would you be saying, you know, I'm French-Irish, which makes me a nicer Irish person? Would you say that to the French?
Oh, no, I couldn't say that because no Irish would trust that.
Yeah, they'd know exactly what you're at. I want to listen to one of your own compositions. We will come to some of Michael's work a little bit later on, but I want to listen to one of your own compositions. This is from your 2022 album, the album was called Maelstrom, and this is a track called Joy. And I just wanted to get to that little bit, Fiona, where this Fiona Monbe playing there on a song called Joy Song from her album Maelstrom. I wanted to get to that little bit where the bass kicks in and the Stefan Grappelli style violin playing almost starts. That is you, pretty much. That mix of classical and jazz is perfectly expressed within that track.
Yes, and also the major feel of it, because it's a very simple melody, and this album explores how with very simple melodies you can then have a place where you can improvise and find things. This is the beginning of the improvisation.
Yeah,
and we go somewhere else.
Yeah, it goes off into other places after that. When did the interest in Irish traditional music come along? You say your mother was from Ireland, from County Tyrone. Did she bring music with her? Was it when you visited Ireland that you got a sense of Irish traditional music?
Yeah, well, I went there quite often as a child to see my family and friends, and so it was part of being over there, and it's just, you know, this music makes me very happy. I'd never really played it myself. I do know tunes, but I listen to it a lot, and I feel it's somewhere a part of me. And being at the moment in Brittany with these musicians, we play together, and it just makes me want to know more about it actually, and to be performing it a bit more. But I'm much more of a classical and jazz violinist.
Yeah. And I suppose I would, if I had to categorize Michael's music, yes, there's a traditional side to it, but it very much has a kind of contemporary art music feel to it as well. And that's very much there in his opera. Which will you be over to conduct that for the tour? Will you be coming to do that, Fiona?
Oh, of course. I have a full Michael Gallen spring. His music is very beautiful in a way. The writing is very actual and contemporain. Mm. But then, you know, I do a lot of première and creation with my ensemble Miroirs Étendus that is performing in Michael's opera over in Ireland next month, His music, I found it really, really very beautiful, because it's very human.
Yes, it tells a great story. The opera tells a great story about a lunatic asylum, a Soviet asylum.
Story.
Yeah.
The story is amazing, and Michael did a lot of research, because that happened actually for real in Monin.
Yes,
and you know, it's this kind of immersive feeling. Sometimes you listen to work and it's like looking to a beautiful painting, but when you listen to Michael music, it's like being in the painting and having the colors around you, you know, right. This kind of it really speaks to some special part of the musicians first and the public also then.
Well, listen, thanks for joining us this evening, Fiona, and safe trip when you do get over to head out on that tour of Everywhere. That's French-Irish conductor and musician Fiona Monbe, who is working in collaboration with composer Michael Gallen. They will be returning to Ireland with the opera Elsewhere in April. Shows at the O'Reilly Theatre in Dublin, the Aontas Arts Centre in Castleblaney, Cork Opera House and the Town Hall Theatre in Galway. Full information you can check out straymaker.com. One of the most hotly anticipated debut novels of the year, Katrina Shine's Habitat, takes place in an Oslo apartment block that, over the course of an increasingly bizarre week, begins to disintegrate around a group of neighbours who can't quite comprehend what they're experiencing. Delighted to have Katrina Shine with me in studio this evening. You know, I could start, Katrina, talking about the seven sets of people who live in the apartment block itself. But the truth of the matter is, the biggest character in this novel is the apartment block, or the two apartment blocks, really, isn't it?
Yeah, the building itself, the materials, yeah.
At the very front of the novel, I had to ask you this before we came in, on page one of the novel itself, I thought it was a side elevation, but you corrected me. It's a section of the building that we see there. You have an architectural background. Talk to me about the nature of this building and the type of building that it is in Oslo.
This is a building from the middle of the last century, from the 50s. So the people who've been living here have been living here for around 70 years. Mm. So it's kind of a community that lives there. This is a functionalist or modernist building. So it's kind of a pinnacle of urban habitation, this kind of building. Yeah.
And then we have another character called Eva, who is the head of the residence committee, essentially.
Yeah.
And what's her character have we got there? And I guess every apartment block is one of these two.
Yeah, I mean, and she is the kind of person who feels like she's always the one who has to solve the problem. People always ring her and ask her, what should they do? In the course of the novel, when the different neighbours encounter problems, they always answer is, we'll just ask Eva what to do. We'll just let her know and she'll fix it. Yeah. And then the novel takes place over the course of a week. It starts on Monday and there's an AGM planned on Friday. Yeah. So that's also, we'll tell that to Eva and we'll bring it up at the AGM on Friday. So they kind of put off the problem until then.
However, there were two sets of characters here that I wondered, and inevitably when you told me you lived in a building like this, I'm thinking, well, there's this pair of architects living up on the top floor of one building, Fritjof and Frida. And then there's this, she's an illustrator. She's been working in advertising, but she's a single woman living down in one of the other apartments, Sonia. Yeah. And it struck me, or am I right in thinking that these seem to have elements of you within them, perhaps given your background in architecture and in that visual side of expression?
Yeah, I would say like all the characters I have, even the old women, I have imagined myself as them as well. But yeah, the idea of creativity, or especially Frida and Fritjof, who are the architects, they are quite comfortable even when things go wrong. They have each other. I don't know. There's something about their situation where, they're dinks. There's a double income, no kids couple, and they have creative lives. So they're quite comfortable in how they live, and that they will be. If somebody's able to solve this problem, it's going to be them.
Yeah. And when Sonia then has managed to get the money together to buy her own apartment, and she's heading out on a new life, and then this being an illustrator, a freelance illustrator, is very much realizing that creative dream in some ways. And you know, when I started reading the novel, I thought, well, yeah, this is going to be about the domestic interactions between all of the people in the various flats and apartments in the block, and the dynamics of all of that. But it becomes something very strange. Not quite immediately, although you sense there's something up here. What sort of things start to happen in the building?
Yeah, without going too far down road. For example, Sonia, who is the illustrator, she notices a draft in her apartment, and it's not coming through. It's not coming from the windows. It seems to be coming through the wall. And this is kind of, it's not something that makes sense. Mm. So she asks Frida and Fritjof what they think, and they come up with theories, and she goes on, tries to figure out what to do.
And each of the apartments in turn has an unusual type of problem, which has to do with the building materials, which has to do with the nature of the building itself. The building, it lives and breathes, one could say. It is a real character here.
Yeah. And there's a lot about barriers in the book. So the party walls between apartments, the roof and the foundations, the external walls, what kind of keeps them apart.
So these strange happenings, and I know you don't want to go too far down too many of them, but strange happenings which seem to be linked into the building addresses us, by the way, we should say that.
Yeah.
Every chapter, some element of the building, maybe the windows of the building speak directly to us, or the roof of the building speaks directly to us, or the stairwells, I think, speak to us at a different point as well. So you were intent on giving this building control of itself in some ways.
Yeah.
The humans think they're in charge, but they're not in charge at all.
No, and I think, in a way, the building elements speak, but when they're not really happy or pleased with themselves that they are performing well for these
These are the materials.
The materials
aren't happy.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, they have, if they could speak and could talk for themselves, they wouldn't, they have kind of a longer time span. So they're struck by a sense of panic when they think of their own destruction. So,
yeah, because the potential problem with all of the things that's happening to the building is that the building, in fact, is kind of self-destructing in some ways, or that something is happening to cause this building to fade away in some way.
Yeah.
Nature is very involved in the various problems that that are happening in the apartments, in each of the apartments. To what extent were you building us here a perfect society, like a microcosm of the world, and nature saying, do you know what now, lads, all of you in your apartments, or us living on this planet, nature is telling us to cop ourselves on, or I'll have to do something to make you cop on.
Yeah, I mean, there are like nature kind of very directly kind of encroaches, like ivy grows through the window at some stage. So
people think there's another section where people think there are birds in their apartment, even though we can't see birds, but there's a sense of the presence of birds in the apartment.
And yeah, these are the kind of, in cities, what kind of wildlife do you see? It's stuff that's been planted there often, and birds are the only kind of really wild creatures that we see in the city. So they're there.
But I wondered, because what we essentially get here is, I suppose for me, I got this sense of the human beings interacting with the building, which is exactly what you as an architect are involved in on a daily basis, you know, creating buildings that interact with the environment, or habitat, as the book is called, all around them. And yet there's a sense here that we're only a little speck, we're a tiny little, our little interaction with the planet is only a millisecond in time. Everything else will outlast it.
Yeah, that's true. And also the kind of social mechanisms that we use, like when we're interacting with our neighbours, or interacting as even like a global community, there are some of the same kind of mechanisms at play. And some of the, I think some of the reasons why like global problems are a problem for us to solve is that it's so intangible, it's so far away, it's kind of hard to understand and kind of get a from cause to effect. And
do you have an anxiety, a large anxiety around, you know, how human beings are interacting with their environments and interacting with nature and what we're doing with the planet? Was that part of the driving force behind writing this novel?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is every reason to be worried. When I was starting this novel, I was working with circular architecture, and I was doing like lots of workshops about the reuse and building materials. We're kind of trying to envision how we could kind of change the building industry. So I was thinking like quite optimistically about how we should adapt our building industry in ways that are enacted. It was quite positive.
One final question. Frida, the architect, is reading the book, The Woman in the Dunes. You might explain what that book is, and were you in fact reading it, or was it part of the inspiration for Habitat?
In The Woman in the Dunes, it's like, the sand keeps flowing into this kind of valley, and they are in the sand dunes,
yes,
and they have to keep digging it away every day, otherwise they'll get swallowed up. So it's kind of a Sisyphus situation that they have to kind of, that they can never...
And quite apocalyptic, really, in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah. It was a little nod that she was reading that book.
A nod in that direction. However, I don't want to go into how the novel finishes. How hopeful are you that we as a race will actually manage to not destroy the planet?
I think we can do it, but we have to. It's possible.
It's possible.
But it just requires that everybody, I don't know, how to solve the problems of the world. Yeah, it is. I think it is possible that we save the world and we save ourselves. But it requires that people to work together and to try to solve things that don't seem, that when the solution isn't easily at hand.
Katrina Shine there talking to me about her novel Habitat, which is published by Lilliput Press. That is our lot for this evening. Research this evening by Niall Fitzmaurice. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. The programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.